Judges chapter 1. After, yes, I was going to say that I don't like generations of students to pass through here 3, 4, or 5, or 6 or whatever years without at least once having an exposition of Paul's letter to the Romans, which is essential reading and study for young Christians who hope to be servants and soldiers of Christ. So we are going to alternate the chapters of the book of Judges with at least the first 8 chapters of Romans. So next Sunday evening it will be the first chapter, or part of the first chapter of Romans. After Israel's incomplete subjection of the land of Canaan, which the book of Joshua records, the book of Judges records the struggles of the godly judges or tribal leaders. They weren't judges in our sense, legal. They were saviors. They were heroes. They were leaders. The struggles of the tribal leaders to preserve the singular identity and health of the nation of Israel was the intent of the people. But despite the strongest of these leaders, such as Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson, Deborah too, of course, remember, the decline of the nation throughout the book of Judges continued until the prophet Samuel and David called the nation back to God. So I'm going to read just a short paragraph from the author's preface of the commentary in the book of Judges by Arthur Kundall. Listen to this. Few periods in Israel's eventual history are as important as the period of the judges. During these centuries, maybe 180 years, the nation took the wrong turning that led to her downfall and near destruction. The apostasy of later generations has its origin in the early years of the settlement, and there is clear line between the time when the nation first went after Baal and the dark ages when the Jerusalem temple itself was defiled with all the trappings of the Baal worship, not excluding cultic prostitutes, as you read of in 2 Kings 23. There is much in Judges, says Arthur Kundall, to sadden the heart of the reader. Perhaps no book in the Bible witnesses so clearly to our human frailty. But there are also unmistakable signs of the divine compassion and long-suffering. And he says, it may be that the modern reader of Judges will hear the warning voice of the Spirit saying, this is not the way, walk ye not in it. Or as the lives of these lesser saviors, he calls the judges here, these lesser saviors are considered, there may be a realization of the need in modern times of a greater savior, of unblemished life, who is able, he means of course the Lord Jesus Christ, to effect a perfect deliverance, not only in time, but in eternity. Yet, we must not forget, you know, when we say this about the book of Judges, we must not forget the Hebrews writer and what he says about some of these warriors. Would you like to look at a little bit of that? Hebrews 11, Hebrews chapter 11, starting at verse 32. After speaking about what's his name, the man who walked with God and was not, Enoch and Noah and Abraham and all the others. He goes on to say at the 32nd verse, and what more shall I say? I do not have time, he says, to tell about Gideon, Barak, and Deborah, of course, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel, and the prophets. Now notice what he says about them. Who through faith conquered strength, and whom became powerful in battle and routed former armies. Now we could read to the end of the chapter, because that's all very thrilling, you see. That's about some of these heroes, you see. But nonetheless, it is true what Kundal says about the decline toward the end of the book. Now, Joshua's last great act was to call the people to Shechem, in the middle of the map there, about that second dot, number two, to Shechem, to renew their covenant with God. And after his death, the people, alas, were left to themselves without a leader. This is the most awful thing that can happen to a people, or to a work of God, whether as a sign of God's judgment or not. It's an awful thing to happen to a people. I cannot see other than that the fact that no leader was provided after Joshua is a divine nemesis or judgment, to be left without a leader. And this, you know, is virtually what we were saying this morning about those Christian groups who view the church as a democracy without leadership. It never works, despite the fact that leaders can lead the church astray, and leaders can lead the nation astray. Yet a nation and a church needs leaders. And we must pray for leaders who will not lead the church astray. Because any man leadership, which still obtains in some Christian groups to some extent, any man leadership is no leadership at all. And it is potentially disastrous, as has been proved. That's history. But now, we may well ask why God allowed such a great gap in Israel's history. Such a great gap of leadership between Joshua and Samuel. Some estimate that the book of Judges covers 180 years, but then you see it may not be so, because some of the incidents that we read in the book of Judges may be concurrent and contemporaneous, you see, so that it may not necessarily cover all that length of time, but we don't know. But I was asking the question, why did God leave such a gap, if it was anything like 180 years, without a leader for Israel? I don't know, except that not even their best judges, you know, ever became national figures. Not one of them. They were all local, or over one or two tribes, not more. But not one of these, even those we're reading about in Hebrews, ever attained mastery and leadership over the whole nation. They were without a national leader for all these years. And what I see is this, that the people did their best, and it was a good best, for they immediately asked the Lord for guidance. That's the very first chapter of the book. asked the Lord for guidance. And he said, long before David, Judah is to continue to fight against the Canaanites, those that you have not subdued. And the Simeonites, being blood brothers, senior indeed to both Levi and Judah, were invited to join with Judah. And virtually, the Simeonites became one tribe with Judah. So together they attacked the Canaanites and the Perizzites in their stronghold of Bezek, which is west-northwest of Jerusalem, between the first and the second black dots there. And they slew a great many and seized their king, the lord of Bezek, mutilated him, poor man, and brought him to Jerusalem between 1 and 2, which they seized. Then, verse 9, they drove south to Hebron, that's number 1, and subdued that area, moving westwards toward the foothills of Judea and the sea coast, and they took that. And there, as we read, Caleb, the contemporary of Joshua, and now an aged man, the only survivor now of the wilderness, he came to the fore again and promised his daughter to the man who captured the city of Kiriath Sepha, southwest of number 1, way down south there, southwest of that dot. And Othniel, his own nephew, took the city and was given Aksa as his wife, and a substantial amount of land, including well-watered land. And, of course, the conquest continued, and they took cities of the plain toward the Mediterranean between 1 and 2, but found it difficult to hold them because the people there had iron chariots, so they confined their conquests largely to the hill country. They retired to the hill country, which has its highest point around Hebron, number 1, and they remained there. Now, Caleb, the old man, was singular in that he drove the giants that had frightened Israel, you remember, nearly 40 years before. He drove the giants out of Hebron and possessed it. That's where, of course, Abraham is buried. Something that Joshua and he, Caleb, had said could have been done 40 years, 38 or 39 years before. But the other 10 spies said, oh no, we can't. And so they didn't go up, and God was grieved with them. You remember. However, and here we come to the sad part of the chapter, the Benjamites, a much smaller tribe, but of course close to Judah, between 1 and 2, were not so successful in dislodging the Jebusites from the Rock of Zion, as it came to be known, Jerusalem. It was an impregnable stronghold, and remained so for long. It was the last place in the land, Jerusalem. Here's an interesting thought. Jerusalem, the great holy Jerusalem, was the last place in the land that Israel really took. And it's an exciting story in the Samuels about how David took it. And here you see, we have the beginning of the sorry tale of how Israel, tribe by tribe, progressively failed to dislodge and drive out or destroy the Canaanites from the land. However, the half-tribe of Joseph, Ephraim, a large tribe, and there further north around number 2, did succeed in driving out the Canaanites from Bethel. But the other half of Joseph's tribe, Manasseh, further north still, at Beth Shan, now that's opposite number 5, a stronghold at the Jordan end of the Jezreel Valley, Bethshan, they were not able to drive out the people of Bethshan, of that region. And that region, of course, included the great valley of Jezreel, where Saul and Jonathan were slain, and the whole Esdraelon Valley, almost as far as Carmel. And you see Mount Carmel jutting out there at the sea, the Mediterranean. That's clear in the map. The best that the Ephraimites could do was to press the Canaanites into forced labor, but they couldn't drive them out. And that, of course, was simply piling up trouble for themselves. Why? Oh, you would know why, wouldn't you? For slaves, you know, can influence masters, as servants can influence masters, as they obviously did in the matter of religion, which was the reason for driving them out. Wasn't it the Hebrew maid that told Naaman to go and wash in the Jordan? Of course it was. The influence of servants and slaves. They thought, you see, if they put them to forced labor, they would keep them down. No. The rest of the first chapter now is therefore one long series of pathetic neithers. Neither did this tribe drive them out, neither did that tribe drive them out, neither did the other tribe. It's most depressing. So that instead, you see, of cleansing the land of its vile inhabitants with their depraved religious customs, and including in some cases human sacrifice, they accommodated themselves to them, falsely satisfying themselves that they had subdued them, only to find, as one does subsequently, that they were perhaps more influenced by these people, these Canaanites, as slaves, possibly through their women folk, who are so often the power behind their men, than they would have been as equals. Oh, yes. That's the great mistake that Israel made. We can't drive them out, but we'll subdue them. No. God said, out! And that's the beginning of Israel's troubles that led to captivity and led to the dispersion, even to this day, although they're hurrying back to Israel. That's gone on for thousands of years because of this. Ephraim was helpless to drive out the inhabitants of Giza. That's west of number 2. And later in the chapter, we find the Danites, opposite number 2 toward the coast, absolutely confined to the hill part of their territory by the Amorites. Another name for the Canaanites, if you like. That was why eventually, you remembered, you know, your Old Testament history, eventually the Danites sought land far north of Galilee, far north of number 3, the top dot there. Dan, you see, you know the phrase, from Dan to Beersheba. Well, that's Dan far, far north of Galilee, you see, right down to Beersheba, down in the Negev. Oh, well, that's where the Danites landed, because the people in the land wouldn't let them get down to the coast. Now, Zebulun, Asher, and Naphtali, three northern tribes, north of the Israelian Valley and Galilee and Nazareth and all that, each one further than the other. Zebulun, Asher to the west, to the coast, Naphtali further north, all failed to drive out the horrid heathen. Indeed, there is a significant change of language. I tried to bring this out during the reading, but notice it. Significant change of language in the course of these verses, from failing to drive out their enemies. And we begin to read of the Canaanites continuing to live there with the Israelites. And then, as if by complete capitulation to them, the tribes of Israel lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. You see the difference? That showed their decline. And of course, that's the way that incipient defeat advances. There is a failure in the fight. And then compromise is almost bound to set in. For you learn to live with what you cannot remove, until it is hardly compromise at all, because you simply sit down among the ungodly and you content yourself with living among them. You see that sort of decline sometimes in people's lives, both individuals and families and even fellowships. We hear a great deal about amicable coexistence politically. And that is what Enoch Powell warned our nation about years ago, if our immigration laws were too lax. But you see how increasingly aggressive and demanding incomers become, not only to the establishing of Islamic mosques proliferating all over the place, but infiltrating into our schools, until British children, they say, come home singing Islamic rhymes. And then that impudent Dr. Siddiqui demands his own Islamic parliament in our land. And we listen, and we are not angry, as we should be. You see, there's no doubt that racial tension is an abiding reality. Not only because of the evident differences in the color of men's skins, but by reason of religious and cultural variations. And you see, where mutual tolerance and eventual coexistence is not achieved because there is no grace, the nations pile up for themselves all sorts of future disorders and disasters. The world is full of it today. A great deal of the trouble in Yugoslavia is due to infiltration of tribes with different religious customs into each other's territories. And we see that very particularly in Soviet Russia, if you can still call it that. It's a new name now, not least among the Azerbaijani Muslims and the Christian Armenians, who can't live together, as also in Georgia and elsewhere. But you may ask, is it not possible to envisage people of different races and colors and customs living together in amity and concord? Yes, if there is at least mutual tolerance or even acceptance of each other's way of life. But how sure can we be of that, where Satan is determined to disrupt mankind by all the means at his disposal, and especially by religious and cultural means to drive men against one another? If grace prevailed, of course, any people of any culture could learn to live with each other. But how far, let me ask you this, how far can you reconcile the Muslim way of life with that of the Christian? We will not be reconciled with Mohammed, will we? Nor will he and his followers be reconciled with Jesus Christ. Never the twain shall meet. And the only hope that Israel could have developed her corporate national life as the people of Yahweh, Jehovah, the Lord. The only way that they could have developed their corporate national life was by driving out all these pagan people or converting them to her God. Then there would have been the chance of universal peace, not otherwise. And whatever you say about this from a secular statesmanship point of view, there is no doubt that God's will for Israel was to drive out the heathen so that Israel should establish herself in the land, as did indeed happen when David conquered the land and then his son Solomon, king of peace, which is the meaning of his name, reigned. The nations came to see the glory of Israel's establishment under the glorious reign of Solomon, Queen of Sheba, and the rest. But that, of course, only lasted a very short time. And even that had the seeds of corruption within it because of Solomon's increasing tolerance of and then acceptance of heathen ways and his marriages with foreign heathen women. But you see, while the glory of Israel lasted in David and Solomon's days, the scene afforded for us prophetically, and does afford for us, a vision of what Israel's task would have been had she remained true to her Lord and had not gone after the pagan gods she brought into the land with her, as well as those she found in the land. If Israel had remained true to her Lord, the Gentile nations would have progressively come to see the glory of a godly kingdom and would have learned, as one day they will learn, thank God, as Isaiah prophesies in chapter 60, that this is the way to live. Now, this is all in the book, in the Bible, and will take place. But alas, there was opportunity for it then to take place, in which case the history of the world would have been very, very different from what it has been and is today. So, what then is our fundamental lesson here tonight? It is one which Israel should have learned from the practice of ridding her homes of leaven during Passover time. For, you see, while the first disuse of leaven, yeast, at Passover was on account of the people's hurry to be away from Egypt with no time to put leaven in the bread, therefore the matzah, sort of water biscuit as we would call it, was called the bread of affliction. At the same time, leaven or yeast, because of fermentation, implied disintegration and corruption, and anything in a decaying state suggested uncleanness, you see. And the rabbi writers often use leaven as a symbol of evil and of man's hereditary corruption. And you can read of that, various places. I'll not take time to it now. Exodus 12, 15 to 20. Matthew, Jesus warns about the leaven of the Pharisees in Matthew 16 and 6. And Paul has a passage about it. 1 Corinthians, we've looked at it already in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 5, 6 to 8. You know, I cannot help associating the significance of leaven with Paul's word in 1 Corinthians 8 and 1. About knowledge puffing up, whereas love builds up. Knowledge inflates, whereas love builds up. Because, you see, the essence of sin, leaven, the essence of sin, yeast, is pride, inflation with self. And there can be little doubt that the reason why so many of the tribes of Israel failed to drive out the Canaanites from the land that was given to them by God was their mixed minds. They were of two minds. They did not have the simplicity of God. You know, God, for all the complexity of this book and the theology and the ramifications of the Holy Scriptures, God is essentially simple and single. But they weren't. They were double-minded. They were, as I was saying during the prayer, arguing with God. Oh no, we'll not drive them out. It's difficult to drive them out. We'll make them our slaves. That was deadly. You see that was deadly, don't you? Had they been sufficiently convinced that what God said was necessary, and they had at his command determined to drive the Canaanites out, they would have proved that God was with them to do so. He would have helped them to do so. As Caleb and Joshua said at Kadesh Barnea 40 years before, God will help us drive the giants out. And ultimately Caleb did drive the giants out when he was a very old man. God will always do the impossible with us if we believe. With God, all things are possible. You know, I fear the reason why the ministry of God's word, even in the power of the Spirit, doesn't have the effect it should on people's minds and hearts and lives is that people either associate the word preached with the sinner who is preaching it. They say, but he's a sinner too. And so they don't take it the same, although it's God's word. And they excuse themselves by saying, I want to listen to what he says. There are people here for years have said that. Well, if they haven't said it, they've lived it. They've lived it. We're not going to care what he says. See that? But it's not what I say. It's what he says. And if I'm not true to what he says, you come and tell me. Right away. Yes, he's a sinner too. And to that extent they do not entertain it as the Lord speaking. Or else, if it is accepted as the Lord's word, then it is ignored or neglected, which is worse, isn't it? Frankly, you see, I don't think some could see their neglect of biblical exhortations as sin. No, they argue, they have their arguments against, you see, else they would not be able to live with it if they believed that what they were not doing was sin. But it is sin, if God has said so, and we refuse to obey what he says. But you see, it is possible because of a spirit of militancy against sin. I've read that badly. Read it again. It is possible because of a spirit of militancy against sin which has been lost to slump into ever greater compromise with doubtful or disobedient things until we are soon lulled to sleep in our consciences, and we go happily or even merrily on as if everything was all right, when deep down we know that it is not, and we have become backsliders. There are backsliders here. Indeed, I think that even the best of us should periodically examine ourselves to see if we are really in the faith. For part of the gift of regeneration, the new birth, now here's some doctrine for you. Part of the gift of regeneration, which is the new birth, which incorporates both justification and sanctification, you can't have the one without the other. Justification and sanctification, although Keswick has often taught that you can. Beware of Keswick teaching now. Listen to James Packer about that. Keswick often teaches that you can have justification without sanctification, with sanctification as a second work of grace. No, no. But I'm saying, part of the gift of regeneration is the renewal of the will towards God. If you're converted, you want to be good. And if you're not converted, you don't particularly want to be good. And if the will, you see, is diametrically opposed to the will of God in any particular, we must ask ourselves if we are really regenerate, really born again. Has our will been renewed? Listen to James Packer. Keswick teaching gives no hint that God's sovereignty extends to the will. On the contrary, we are told again and again that God's ability to sanctify Christians is entirely dependent on their own willingness to be sanctified. No, he says. Now let me say, I'm not saying that this is true of Keswick teaching today. I haven't been at Keswick since 1952. I've been in the town, but not at the convention. They threw me out, you see, but that's another story. I'm not saying that they're teaching this, but this is authentic Keswick teaching, and who should know in the world if James Packer doesn't know? Now, where was I? No, Reformed doctrine links sanctification to regeneration, representing both operations as centering on the will. And I go from James Packer to the Westminster Confession of Faith, which says, when God converts a sinner and translates him into the state of grace, he frees him from his natural bondage under sin. You remember that Paul says in Romans 6:14, sin shall not, and it's dogmatic, it's imperative, sin shall not have dominion over you, you see. Yes, the confession says, when God converts a sinner and translates him into the state of grace, he frees him from his natural bondage under sin, and by his grace alone enables him freely to will and to do what is spiritually good. Yet so that by reason, not perfectly, nobody's perfect down here, yet so that by reason of his remaining corruption, he does not perfectly nor only will that which is good, but does also will that which is evil. The will of man is made perfectly and unchangeably free to do good alone in the state of glory only. But that doesn't absolve us from acting according to our will, the will that God has transformed by his grace. So be it. But someone, you see, who habitually refuses to will what is good when God indicates it plainly to them, should nevertheless ask himself or herself whether there is really a tension between good and evil within him, or whether the good, being adamantly refused, there is no new birth there at all. Are you a Christian? Are you born again of God? That's the question. I'm reading, you know, a 10-page letter from one who many years ago was greatly used of God to the conversion of others here in Gilcomston, and who married an academic, and they went abroad and had numerous children, all apparently now serving the Lord. But the husband progressively withdrew from Christian activity and ultimately left his wife, and subsequently found himself in deep waters in another part of the world. I wrote to her years ago suggesting that perhaps her husband was never converted. And she now writes in this 10-page letter to me this week to say that that is perhaps the truth. But she was so sure when they were courting that he was, although she admits that she recalls him giving a testimony at some meeting somewhere, which she said puzzled her. You can't be too sure about another person's conversion, especially if you're going to marry them. I wonder, you know, how many on the fringe of our congregation are really, really regenerate, when there is so little sign, apart from fulfilling certain limited duties, that they are. What are the signs? Shining for Jesus? Let us see the shine. You see, there was no doubt about Judah's zeal for the Lord after the death of Joshua, or Simeon's zeal either, although Benjamin failed to drive the Jebusites out, as Manasseh and Ephraim and Zebulun and Asher and Naphtali also all failed to do. Was it their fault? Now, let's argue this closely as I draw to a close. Was it their fault that they weren't able to drive the Canaanites out? Or was it that the Lord had a special purpose for Judah? Well, he had. But does that excuse the others? We are all always sinners. And Judah was sinners too. And so we are always culpable, blamable. It is sin that is the hindrance. But you see, is sin excused because God has not a specific purpose for us? Hardly, hardly. But how may we know that God has a particular purpose for our lives? Is it not because we are led to stir our zeal to do exploits for him? How do you know that God is not calling you to some special endeavor? What you would need to be on your spiritual toes to find out. And if you're not on your spiritual toes, maybe your telephone's out of order. You see, that would be serious, wouldn't it?
That's the question. Some, I believe, fear to be on their toes, lest they be asked to do something they don't want to do. God wanted Israel to subdue the whole of Canaan. That was his expressed will and desire. And they didn't do it. And that wasn't because he had a special task only for Judah, but not for the rest. Maybe he hadn't a special task for Judah at all, but simply that they bestirred themselves. In which case, all honor to them and all shame to the rest. For stirring themselves less than the command of God called for. God had said to Joshua, I will give you every place you set your feet on, as I promised Moses. Now, did that promise die with Joshua? I don't believe it did. It was still valid, because they hadn't possessed the land and driven the Canaanites out. It was up to them. And God's special purpose for Judah was seen only in the zeal they displayed. Well, they went to the Lord and said, Lord, what are we going to do? And you won't do that if you're not willing to do what you think he might ask you to do. You'll run a mile, Jonah, and land in a whale.